Good morning.
Good morning.
If you had told me a year ago that I was going to stand up and do something like this, I would not have believed you at all. Not even maybe 6 months ago. I've done a lot of teaching over the years. I was Megan's Sunday school teacher. But I've never done a sermon. I've done a lot of telling Marianne Irvin this last week. I'm sure my children will think I gave a lot of sermons, but they don't actually count. But, I mean, any time I want to get up on my soapbox is fun, but this is totally different. When I asked Daryl when I agreed to do this to give me some advice, and he said to find my own voice. And I thought that was great advice because I can't be like Daryl. I don't know how to converse with a robot. I don't know how to make really great jokes, but I'm going to speak in my own voice, and I'm just going to trust that the Spirit of God will use that. Have anybody here ever purchased anything from IKEA? Or anything like IKEA? It's where you get all this huge booklet of instructions. There's no words. You get one little teeny tiny Allen key, and you're expected to make a china cabinet. And as you're going along, you're going along your way and you're making your china cabinet and it's looking okay, but then you get to this point where something just doesn't look right. And you think you've made a mistake, maybe you have a piece missing, but all you know is there's something not right here. This does not look right. And so your dilemma is, do I take it apart and start all over again, or do I try to wing it with what I have? We get confused and we get perplexed about all of this, but we don't know what to do, and we just want to know what we need to do to go on from there. I find this is a really good metaphor to describe what happens to us in our spiritual lives when we get to a place where we may not like what we see. We're going along, doing our thing, we're going to church, we're serving, we're doing whatever, but we get to a point and we say, wait a minute, something doesn't feel right here, something is wrong. And it's not anything really to be afraid of, because we're human beings and our faith is tested sometimes more than others. It's something that should cause us to stop and ask, why does this not look right? What is wrong? We might call it a crisis of faith. We might call it a dark night of the soul, but we usually have those moments. I think we all have those moments at one point or another. And I found myself in that place not all that long ago. Growing up, my family were not churchgoers, other than saying the Lord's Prayer and having been baptized as a child and going to school, say the Lord's Prayer in school and watching Charlton Heston be Moses in the Ten Commandments. I did not have any training at all as a child about who God was. And it wasn't until I was in my late teens that I actually started to ask the question about who was God. And I think I was 20 by the time I could call myself a Christian. Now, at the time, I was in a very conservative evangelical community. Looking back now, I think fundamentalist is a little bit more accurate to describe it. And there were certain things that I was encouraged that I needed to believe in order to be a Christian, and it was things like believing in the rapture, not drinking, not smoking, separating myself from the world. And the longer I was in that environment, the more the list of you can't do this began to grow. And I started to want to know, to understand why. Why I am terrible for wanting to know why. I always want to know why. And I wanted to know, why can't I do this? Why? Why? And I've always loved to study and to read and to try to figure these things out. But the more I did this, the more questions I had. So I really wasn't getting anywhere. And so I decided that I would go to seminary. And I would learn more. I didn't go to seminary to be able to do this today. I never anticipated that I would do this today. A lot of people do go to seminary for that reason, but it wasn't me. And I was challenged once I got there regularly with these same questions. And I met people who had different views than I did. I had to read books that were way out of my comfort zone. And I realized I was getting more and more challenged by what I believed. And I think I started to feel like my faith was based so much more on what I rejected rather than what I actually believed. And I started to wonder, was I believing these things because I was told to? Was I just trying to fit in? And that was a real quandary throughout my entire time at seminary. And I was not the only one there. I met quite a few students, women students, actually. A lot of us would sit together and talk about these things. And one semester I decided to write a paper about the women, the limits of women in ministry in the church. Now, up until that time, I totally did not believe that I should be speaking here today. In fact, I was really critical of people who didn't agree with me, even though I hadn't studied it out. A lot of times I like to go back and just like shake myself and say, smarten up, and it's unfortunate that you can't do that. But as I went through the paper and was doing the research, it was for the entire semester, I started to realize that I had been wrong about a few things. And by the end of the research time was over, I had done a complete turnaround about what I believed. And some of the opinions I had about other people before, I realized I hadn't been fair all that time. And I also learned that being wrong is not the worst thing in the world. You know, we're all afraid to be wrong, but I think being wrong is an important part of life, is to be able to say, you know, I was wrong, and I was wrong about that. Well, then the pandemic happened while I was in seminary, and it seemed like the world had gone mad. There was all these divisions in the church, and people were polarized about things, and there were more these do not do this things added to my list of the things that I wasn't supposed to do. I wasn't supposed to get vaccinated because that meant that I was living in fear instead of faith. I wasn't supposed to follow the municipal guidelines about gathering in public places because that meant I was obeying man and not God. And I wasn't supposed to speak out against social injustice or anti-racism because that meant I was woke and I might be a threat. And I felt like everybody was picking these banners. You know, like you have teams, like they had VBS a couple weeks ago. You have your banners, and there were some in the gym. They were rockets, and the groups would sort of line up under their banners. Well, there were these banners, but there was the anti-vax banner and the political conservatism banner and the Christian nationalism banner and all these banners. But where was the banner that said Jesus? And I began to think something doesn't look right here. There's something wrong. And I have to admit that I really struggled even going to church, because I thought, okay, I was wrong about the women in ministry thing. Am I wrong about everything? Like, is there anything salvageable from church, from Christianity, amidst all these questions that I was having? And I wanted to know, like, what is the bare minimum, the very bare minimum that I need to do to believe in order to be called a Christian? And that, I decided to start over again rather than doing the wing it thing like you do in IKEA. I don't wing it well. If I have a mistake, it usually means picking everything out and starting over again. And that's what I did. And this led me to the scripture passage that I'm going to read today. It's Mark chapter 12, verses 28 to 31. And in this passage, Jesus is confronting the scribes and the teachers of the law. And these people frequently challenged Jesus about his teaching. A lot of time they wanted to trip them up. They wanted to trip him up in what he was saying. But honestly, sometimes the teachers get a bad rap because they were just trying to understand as well. So they just really wanted to know, what do you believe? So in this passage, it says, one of the scribes came near and he heard them disputing with one another. And seeing that he, Jesus, answered them well, he asked him, which commandment is the first of all? And Jesus answered, the first is, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength. The second is this, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. There are no other commandment greater than these. So the scribe asked him, what's the first commandment of all? In other words, what's the greatest commandment? I think there might be some versions of the New Testament that use the phrase, what is the greatest commandment? There were 613 laws in the Torah. So I think if I was following Torah, I might like to know, which one can I safely not worry about? Which is the greatest one? And Jesus answers with the words that would have been very familiar to a Jewish audience. He's quoting Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 to 5, which is known as the Shema. And the word Shema in Hebrew is the word for to hear or to listen. And Jewish people recite this twice a day. And this is their creed. Like in Christianity, we have the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, basic statements about what we believe. This was the Jewish creed, and this is what they believed. And so he was actually using a prayer he himself would have grown up with to teach the crowd. And we're told to love with all our heart all our mind, all our soul, all our strength, and you've got this four list of things, and it might be tempting to think what each individual one means and what's different about them, but I don't really think that's the point. The point here is that, and it's actually interesting because it's been woven in through the worship songs today, is that we are to love with all we have. It's a complete, total love. It's not the individual words that matter. It's this picture of you love God with everything you have in you. And it's loyal and entire, and it's not lip service. And it's something that's going to change. If we seek to love God in this way, it can't help but make a difference in the way we act and the way we talk. And the second commandment is that we love our neighbors as ourselves. And this is also a quotation from the Old Testament. This is from Leviticus 19, and it's in this long list of all these other moral laws that they were to follow. And we're to love others as ourselves. And that idea of loving yourself, I think it takes a bad rap, because a lot of people say to love yourself is pride. But it is not pride to love yourself. It's a basic God-given instinct in human beings to care for themselves. So, you know, I'm not going to walk out in the middle of the street when there's cars. I'm going to protect myself. And so we're to give other people just as much concern and love as we would give ourselves. And obviously, that's a hard thing. So how do we love God? What does it look like to love God? And that's a big question, and you can spend your entire life, and people probably have their whole life, trying to figure out what that means. In Deuteronomy, back in the days of the Old Testament, that meant following the law. So all those sacrifices, all those 613 commands, that's how you demonstrated your love for God, was following all of these commandments. But for us today, the answer to how to love God is to love Jesus. And that's a little bit different. In another passage in the New Testament, Jesus is having a conversation with his disciples, and he's telling them, in the book of John 14, he's telling them he's going to be going away. It's in the book of John, that last speech he gives to them before he's about to go out and be crucified. And he says to them, you know, I'm going away. And obviously they're troubled by this, but then he comforts them by saying, God's prepared a place for you. The Father's prepared a place for you, and you're going to see me again. But they're confused, which the disciples were very often confused, the apostles, if you read the New Testament. Sometimes they were like Peter, and they're going, yeah, Lord, and the next thing you know, it's like, man, I just denied the Lord three times. But that's kind of comforting in a way to me, because that means they're human beings. We do it all the time. Philip is very confused, and he says, Lord, just show us the Father, and we'll be satisfied. And Jesus answers him by saying, Philip, I've been with you all this time, and you still don't get it. And then he goes on and says, whoever has seen me has seen the Father. To see Jesus is to see God. Jesus is God in human form. That's the basis of how Christianity is different from many, many other religions, is that Jesus and God are the same thing. So to love God is to love Jesus, and to love Jesus is to follow him. Later in that same passage, in verse 15, Jesus said, if you love me, you will keep my commandments. And the commandment he has just given is, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and then love neighbors as yourself. So how do you love God? You love Jesus, and you do what Jesus said, and that's to love other people. Those are the basics. Those are the bare minimum of what, for me and for you, is that's what a Christian is somebody who loves God with everything and loves his neighbor as himself. Of course, there are other things associated with it, but if you don't have that, you don't have a good beginning. And Jesus says that we're supposed to love our neighbors, and, you know, who are our neighbors? And that was another question that Jesus answered. In Luke chapter 10, a lawyer asks Jesus, how can I inherit eternal life? And Jesus tells him the Shema. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and love your neighbor as yourself. And then the lawyer says to him, but who is my neighbor? And that's when he goes into one of the most famous parables, the parable of the Good Samaritan. Even people who have never gone to church or not a Christian knows what a Good Samaritan is. We know what that is. And in this parable, if you went to Sunday school, you've heard it. If you've taught Sunday school, you've probably told it. A man is walking to Jericho. He gets attacked by robbers, and he's beaten up and left on the side of the road. And he's lying there, and a Levite passes him by and crosses to the other side of the street. And then a priest goes by and he doesn't help him either, but it's the Samaritan who helps him. And the Samaritans and Jews were basically enemies. They didn't really have much to do with each other. But the Samaritan is the one that helps him. And the parable ends with Jesus asking the lawyer, which one of these do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? And the lawyer says, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus says to him, go and do the same. So the Samaritan was not obligated to help the Jew, but the Levite and the priest were. Under the law, they were supposed to help him, but they didn't. They just kept going. And under the law, they should have helped him, but they didn't. But the Samaritan just did it. Now, our neighbors are anyone who comes into our path. When we read that parable, it's anybody that comes along our way, anybody that we intersect with on a daily basis. Our own families are even our neighbors. I remember trying to teach this to my kids about how, you know, be nice to your siblings because they're your neighbor and you're supposed to love your neighbor. I don't know if that worked or not, but I had to try it. But there is something significant about helping someone that we're not obligated to help. It's a real test of love to help someone that we're not obligated to help. Our neighbors are anybody that we come in contact with, whether it's the person who serves you your food at a restaurant or the person across the street or just people that we work with, that we interact with every day. And if we follow Jesus, we're also his disciples. Everybody's a disciple. And a disciple is just somebody who learns with the intent of following the teacher. So we don't just follow along blindly. We follow Jesus waiting to be taught by him and understanding that he's going to change our hearts and he's going to affect our teaching. And we can learn how to love others by watching how Jesus loved each other people. And the Gospels especially are full of the ways he showed compassion and forgiveness and healing. And one of the things that has really helped me over the last little while about thinking about this basic truth of love is that the miracles that Jesus did, the healing miracles especially, were about restoring them. It was definitely getting rid of the physical ailment, but there's an element of restoration in what he did. For example, there's a story about a woman in the book of Mark, and she's following Jesus in this huge crowd of people. She knows that if she touches him, she can be healed. And she's described as somebody who's been bleeding for 12 years. So she clearly has some kind of woman's ailment, and because of that, she's unclean. And if you're unclean, you can't come inside the community. If you're outside the camp, you can't come and you can't have fellowship if you're unclean. So not only is she physically unwell, she's also personally affected by this because she can't be in the community with her family. She can't be with the people that love her. She's sort of banished. And then when Jesus heals her, he is giving her not only a new body, he's giving her a new experience by being able to be with her family. Just think about 12 years of, you know, not being able to be with their community. We were all, you know, we found all of us very hard not to be with our church communities during the pandemic. And think about that for 12 years. I mean, I think we were all pretty tired of it within about the first 6 months. And having leprosy was a similar situation. Every time Jesus healed a leper, it enabled them to come back into the community because for obvious reasons, you have to keep people with leprosy outside the community. But he restored them. And so that idea of love and restoration, it's built right into the resurrection because Jesus, his death on the cross was an ultimate act of love and it was restoring us. Humanity was separated from God, but his death and burial and resurrection made it possible for us to be reconciled to him. So there's this element of reconciliation involved in love. And when we think about this just on a human level, loving people, it doesn't involve creating these false boundaries. It's not supposed to be about separating people. It's not about exclusion. It's more about inclusion. And as Christians, if we want to be known to other people as those who love, then we need to be promoting that. It's trying to bring people in together to bring those false boundaries, getting rid of them. And it is normal for us to gravitate towards people that are like us. It's a human thing, you know. There are certain interests that I have, so I do gravitate to people like that. But when those become a way to exclude someone, then that's not consistent with love. And if we say, oh, yes, I love everyone, and then just to say, I don't want to love those people, then that's not consistent with what we're called to do. We have to try to bring people in. And that, you know, practically speaking, you can think about, I was thinking about this when I was working at Riverside last week, just they want it to be a place where anybody can come in and come together. And that's the idea of reconciliation, is that it's not just for that person, it's for everybody. But loving our neighbor doesn't come easily. In fact, it can be really hard, not just because we don't like the person, but some people are hard to love because maybe they're a little bit shyer than somebody else. Maybe they've been hurt and they don't open up. Maybe they're a little bit suspicious when you try to love them. And I was thinking about the book, The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman. I don't know if has anybody ever heard of that book, The Five Love Languages by Gary Chapman? It was really popular in the 90s, and it was used especially in marriage and child raising groups because it's an excellent principle. Find out how the people you love receive love, because we all don't receive love or express love in the same way. And the five love languages are words of encouragement, physical touch, quality time, acts of service, and gift giving. Now, I'm just going to say here, I don't think those are the only love languages. I don't think there can only be five. But for the purposes of this guy's book, it is not an unhelpful thing, especially when you have a small a child, when if you tend to show love with words of encouragement, but your child would rather have a hug, then that actually, you know, maybe your child doesn't receive the love that way. So it's a helpful thing, and I think that's the point of the book, is to show that, you know, everybody has a different love language. Now, for me, my love languages are words of encouragement and acts of service. So if Neil is cleaning the toilet while extolling my many virtues, then I feel really loved. And Neil, his love languages are physical touch and quality time. So if I sit real close to him on the couch and watch Star Trek, then he's very happy. So, but that's something that, you know, we've had to learn about each other. And the point of that is not that, you know, we need to seek out every person's love language. I mean, that might become apparent to you. The idea is that love is proactive. It's definitely an emotion. I can remember, actually, Neil and I had a big argument about this when we were dating, and I was really annoyed when he was saying, well, love isn't an action, an emotion, it's an action. And of course, he was like a dumb 21-year-old, so he may have amended that since, but he was right in one sense. Love is an emotion that we feel, but it's also has feet. You want to do something for somebody, and that means that loving our neighbors means getting to know them, talking to them, listening to their stories, finding out more about them, asking questions, and sometimes it means occasionally not being the center of attention or not being the one doing the talking. And I have to confess, I have trouble with that one. I've had to really remind myself, I have a friend that I don't get to see her all that much, so whenever we get together, when I'm driving there, I always tell myself, no, make sure that you ask her this and this and this and this, because I tend to just, you know, sometimes we go on about ourselves. But that's how we show love. It's an action. It's not just some random feeling. And Jesus, he didn't hesitate with who he engaged with. He associated with every kind of person there was. And we all know that, there was people that were outside of the social margins that was unacceptable for him to be socializing with, but he did it anyway. And he valued people. And when we think about it, what is it that gives us our value? Why am I valuable? Why are you valuable? We live in a world that puts value as a reflection of what we do. People are valuable because they have earned a lot of money, or this person is valuable because they're a good musician or an actor. This one's a value because he can get a million followers on social media, or they've got political power. We place value on what you've done, but just think about the logical conclusion from that. If I base my value as a human being on what I can do, I'm going to get to a point in my life where I can't do that anymore, and then I'm going to wonder where my value. And unfortunately, we tend to look at the older generations. We tend to see them that way at times. That's a struggle. We don't think they're valuable. I had an elderly neighbor that lived next door to me, and when we first moved into our house, his leaf, it was in September, so it was like leaf raking season, and he had a huge birch tree and a huge maple tree in his front yard. And it was like a religious experience for him to go out there and rake the leaves. He blew the leaves into a pile, and then he mowed the leaves with his lawnmower. And then he got the vacuum thing, and he sucked up the leaves. And he would do this all day, every day. But eventually, he wasn't able to do it anymore. And then when we tried to do it for him, he chased us off of his lawn. But he wasn't able to do that. And so if he was placing his value, his worth as a human being on being able to rake those leaves, then all of a sudden, does that mean that I'm not worthy anymore? I don't have any value. The reason why we're valuable is because we are created in God's image. Everybody is created in God's image. We're image bearers of God. That is what gives us our value, not how much money we make, the color of our skin, our ethnicity, nothing. None of that is why we're valuable. We're valuable because God created us. And it means that it gives us a point of reference to start loving people that we find hard to love with. Because I admit it, I had a really hard time loving the people that were telling me that I shouldn't have gotten vaccinated. And I was having a hard time loving the people that showed up in the church with no mask on, even though there were guidelines. I really had a hard time. So even though it's hard, I have to love that person anyway. Because if I really love God, then I will love his creation. So it's not always easy, but at least the directive is clear. So this idea of what do I do next? Well, the idea is that you love God, and it's not easy, but it's pretty simple. In the book of 1 John, we're told, "Beloved, let us love one another, because love is from God. Everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. God is love, and those who abide in love abide in God, and God abides in them." Love is the defining characteristic of the Christian. In the Gospel of John, Jesus said, "I give you a new commandment, that you love one another just as I have loved you. You also should love one another. By this, everyone will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." And we're all Jesus' disciples. We're all following him. We're all learning. And if people can't see our love, how will they know we're Christians? How will they know who we are if they don't see that we love? Or especially if we are at odds with our fellow Christians, because there's probably one of the most destructive things to the church is when Christians fight and disagree. I mean, just think about how the church has been discredited over the past few years because of the way people fought over things during the pandemic and continue to have. I mean, I have family members that are not Christians, and I know that one of my brothers even said to me during the pandemic, "How can you stay in the church when that's the way people are?" And that's a sobering question when somebody asks you that. And it's a basic truth. If we can't love our fellow Christian, can we love anybody? To love God is to abide in God. In 1 John it says that loving God is to abide in God. So if we don't love, we're actually interfering with our relationship to God because we're missing out on what it means to abide in God. One of the things I learned over my time in seminary is that it's very easy to create a debate about really obscure things. I mean, there's entire volumes written about a single Greek word in the New Testament, and there's entire volumes written about these obscure doctrines that not the average Christian is probably never going to want to know about. But those things don't mean a whole lot if we don't have love, if we're not taught to love. And I think sometimes we get the idea because the command is so simple and basic that everybody should be able to figure out, but it's actually very hard. Some of the most basic truths are the most difficult to grab onto. And the debates don't accomplish anything in the end. There's always going to be a debate. You can debate about whether Christians should vote for a particular party or whether they should drink alcohol or attend a same-sex wedding. You can debate about those things, and who knows what they'll be debating about 10 years from now. But the thing that's going to stay the same is, what is our expectation to be before God? It's to love other people. That's the thing that doesn't change. And as I have come to a place where, obviously, because we're coming to this church, where I can be in church again and I can grab onto the things to just keep starting, the idea of love has been very important for me because it's the hard thing to do. And if I can do that, then the other stuff, you know, might not always go the way I think, but if we can just love other people, then we know that we're doing something right. And that's an encouragement.